This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Vera Payne here, live from the MVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. You hear people say that you should prepare for retirement by investing, but how do you know what to invest in? How much should you invest? Your life savings, or should you just take out a loan? I mean, what about real estate as an investment? Joining me to explain all of this is CEO of Home Union, Don Ganguly. Thanks for joining me, Don.
Glad to be here.
Could you tell me a little bit about yourself?
You know, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I'm no, you know, different than any other entrepreneur. I mean, we get charged up about, you know, ideas and creating something of value. And you know, the other thing in a business like this is you're helping people invest. You're helping their pocketbooks directly. And it's very different if I was, you know, making a little chip that went into another chip that went into a system that ended up somewhere else. And it would be still a very valuable chip, but it didn't have a sort of a direct line of sight to the customer like we do. I mean, everything we do impacts a customer's life, livelihood, their finance, their portfolios, and what have you. So that's, I think, an exciting part of something I've always enjoyed, you know, doing something that touches the lives of people one way or the other. So that's a little bit about me.
When it comes to your clientele, have you ever noticed that they have some misconceptions when it comes to investing?
Yeah, you know, real estate is such a visible business, and there are so many misnomers around, you know, how you can make money in real estate, and part of what use things is the fact that you have all these real estate gurus that get on television and also have these seminars where they tell you how you can buy real estate with no money down and that you can, you know, just make it your full-time job by flipping properties and doing things which are not for everyone, right? I mean, so a lot of people have that notion that somehow they can get into real estate with no money. They can, you know, buy that one little house and then all of a sudden become a millionaire very quickly. And it's by and large propagated by all these trainers that actually make money from these training classes and also in many cases make commissions from the homes that people buy and stuff like that. You know, while the, you know, the motive may be, you know, praiseworthy that you want to get people into an alternate asset class, I think the methodology is very far removed, you know, because if you take the stock market as an analog, you know, there are day traders that people are out there trying to look at stocks going up and down and trading during the day and making a buck, but that's not for the faint of heart, and not everybody can do that, right? So most of us are, you know, with someone that's managing whatever money we give them to manage. And in real estate, somehow that principle falls down. I mean, a lot of people come in and say, gee, here's this really great property. You should buy it. You can make a lot of money doing this. And so the individual gets excited, buys a property, and then they have to find somebody in a remote location, a local property manager, somebody else trying to manage that property. So that model is flawed, right, because the performance of the property is so dependent on whoever is getting it ready and whoever is managing it. So, you know, it's almost like you going to Fidelity or Merrill or Schwab and saying, I have this much money, what sort of a portfolio should I build? And they ask you a bunch of questions, and then, you know, they build you a portfolio of stocks and bonds and what have you. And then you say, you know, and so how are you going to manage this? And they say, no, we're not going to manage it. You know, Joe's portfolio shop across the street is going to manage it for you. And that's what's happening in real estate today, is that there's no link between the people peddling the properties or the people managing the properties. And that's sort of the gap that, you know, we've tried to bridge. And that's why our whole moniker is, you know, you invest, we do the rest. So we do everything from, you know, the selection to the acquisition to the renovation to the management of the property to trading it on the platform. And we, you know, do it on the back of big data analysis to know which properties are right, which are not, which will perform, which won't. And we built a ton of technology along the way to support the operations so we can, you know, do it in the most cost-effective way. But every time we talk to people, it's that misnomer is there. You know, can I do this with $5,000? And, you know, you can't.
you know, I think I'm probably one of those people like, hey, $5,000. Like, why can't I do something with $5,000? How much should you, give if you want to properly invest?
So, you know, it depends on whether you want to own a home or whether you want to sort of be part of a crowdfunding situation, right? Now, if you want to own a home in a decent sort of Midwestern, Southern neighborhood, you know, the homes, the decent homes are anywhere from $130,000, $140,000 to maybe $300,000. And we, you know, we categorize neighborhoods from A to C. And that just means that a C neighborhood has a higher yield, like a C bond, but it also has higher volatility. So you may see more turnovers and things of that nature. So it allows people to calibrate their investments just like you can do in real estate, right? If I went to you and I said, I could put some of your money in emerging market stocks, and but just a piece of it because that's high risk, and some of it I'm going to put in IBM or an Apple and stuff like that. So the only way you can do that if you can associate a degree of risk with, you know, the potential returns of these companies. And the lower the risk, the higher the stock value of the company. Same thing with homes, right? You know, the lower the risk, the more you pay for the home, and the more your downside's protected, the lower the yield, and then you're really punting for the price of the value going up, and less people can participate at those high ends. You know, where the costs are, on the two costs, we've got real high-priced homes with not enough rent, and people are negative, and they are waiting for that $700,000 home to become $1.5 million, but not everyone can afford to do that. So if you take that and say, I'm going to buy something between $150,000 and $300,000, then, you know, you need to put 20 to 25% down. You know, the government does give you up to 10 loans, like the one you have on your own house. So the good thing about real estate is you can actually get an investment loan, very similar to the one that you need to do, when you do buy your house. Now, you're already looking at $30,000 there, and then some expenses to get it up and running. So pretty soon you get in the neighborhood of $40,000 if you're going to participate and own a piece of property with leverage, with a loan. Now, if you don't want to own the home, and a lot of people want to own the home, you don't want to own the home, you want to get into a crowdfunding situation where, you know, there's a group of five properties or one apartment, and you can put $5,000 or $10,000 and be part of a fund, then, you know, you can do that. But then you're stuck with that fund for whatever period of time that fund is there. You can't sell your own property like you do in that other situation, but your price to pay is a lot less. Now, most of those offerings have sort of regulatory issues, right, because the normal offerings are for people who are what they call accredited investors. So they have to make over $200,000. They have to have a net worth of $1 million. And so it's restricted, again, to people at that end. And now there are some new regulations, right, Regulation A, where it's being opened up to others who can do that. And so if you're going under that regulation, then the other way to participate is $5,000 to $10,000 or whatever the minimum is into a fund that's managed by a company. You know, it could be like us that have a group of properties. You come in, you put that money in, and now you let it ride with 10 other people till, you know, that comes to some sort of fruition. But those are the only sort of two ways you can do it. Now, if you're a big dog, you can get into syndications and you have access to other things, but those are, you know, bigger checks as well. So you know, those are really, you know, sort of the strata. Now, there are other people that are trying to buy some highly distressed homes and get a loan to, you know, buy the home, renovate it, and then flip it to a homeowner. So they're out hunting for distressed assets in various parts of the country. And there are companies that have cropped up to serve, you know, they're called these flippers, that are looking for homes that they could buy on the cheap and then get it renovated and then sell it. But then, you know, that's a full-time job.
Yeah, that's the part that I know about, only because of TV shows. There's so many TV shows out there right now for, like, flipping property. I know my father loves to watch those. But yeah. Are those more realistic for, like, the middle class and lower, where we can, that's what we would have to do if we wanted to invest in property? We'd have to buy it ourselves and almost get our hands dirty and flip it like that?
It's such a specialized deal, right? I mean, think of the same thing in stocks, right? If I were to tell you, go buy these real value stocks that are trading under and go and hold it and flip it, I mean, it's a non-trivial task, right? You got to go find these homes from courthouse steps or foreclosure sites or scour somebody that's willing to sell in a distressed way. You got to make sure it's in the right neighborhood. Then, you know, you have to have the wherewithal to actually, you know, repair and rehab that home, right? So you're now in the construction business because you got to rip stuff apart. You know, it could be more structural stuff, not just countertops and floors. And then once you do that and get that home up to a certain standard, then you got to go find a buyer in the local market to go buy the home. So it's not a business without risk, right? You know, you need, you know, subject matter around construction because you spend too much on that. You eat into your profit. You need to know how to manage a contractor and maybe even swing a hammer. And you need to know where to go find these properties, and you don't want to find them in the worst kind of places where, you know, even if you get it sort of fixed up, you're not looking at a big flip on the other side. You know, so the estimate of the number of people doing that is, I don't know, 15,000 people in the U.S. that sort of do this full-time. And there are a lot of sort of lenders that service them to do the flips. But it's not for the faint of heart, right? I mean, it's for people with that specific expertise. It's just like there's so many day traders. Same example. You know, you've got to go find the stocks you want to trade. You monitor it all day. You figure out when it goes down. You buy it. Then the moment it goes up, you sell it. And, you know, it's a high-frequency deal. So it's not for the common folk. I mean, the common folk are experts at what they do. They could be a doctor, engineer, nurse, teacher, electrician, and that's what they know well. And so if they want to diversify out of the stock market into something like real estate, that doesn't mean that they've, you know, got to become a general contractor and start doing stuff like this. They need to go someplace where they can put their money to work and diversify from the stock market. And that's, you know, that's what we see in most of our clients are, you know, all in on the market and they're nervous and they want to take some of their money out and put it in real estate, but they don't have an efficient way of doing it because they already own a home where they live. They don't want to buy another home. It's not diversification. Sometimes it's very expensive. And so ideally they would like to buy where prices are more reasonable, rents are high, but they can't get to it. I mean, they don't know how to evaluate those homes. They don't know how to buy them. They don't know how to fix them. They don't know how to rent them. So we do all those things. So and our goal is to sort of make it as easy as investing in stocks and bonds. So you use the same kind of parameters, your amount, quantum of investment, the type of risk you want to take, and we have automated engines that match up the available curated inventory that we put on our site to people's preferences and then make it very easy to acquire the property, renovate it, and we've got lots of sort of stops along the way to back out if you don't like something in our due diligence on the property. So investors like that because our investors may be on the coast. The property could be in Chicago and Atlanta. And when we do the due diligence, we may find something that, you know, that we don't like, and then we have an option to back out and go move on to something else. So those are the sort of things that could become a nightmare for an investor if they, you know, buy something that has problems and it becomes a money pit then.
So when it comes to diversifying your portfolio, have you ever had like a client come to you and say, oh man, you know, this is going to be the next hot thing. This has to be part of my portfolio. And you're sitting there saying, maybe you should play it safer. I mean, is it always smart to jump on the next big thing?
You know, it's what do the people say? Buy when people are selling and sell when people are buying, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes you go with the herd, you know, you could be off if you're late, so... You know, we're not, I mean, we're real estate guys, right? So we're not in the investment business of what to do with the rest of their portfolio. I mean, we get into the conversation when they say, you know, listen, you know, I have all my money in the market. I'm nervous. All I can find are expensive stuff in my backyard. This is the amount of money I want to put to work. What can I get? And here's what my preferences are. And so then we have a system based on technology and data that we can say, okay, you know, based on what you just said, here's what the system's saying is your best bet in terms of, you know, you should buy, you know, this property in Tampa, maybe this one in Florida, you know, in Chicago, maybe that one in Atlanta, and this is a portfolio of two or three properties that actually make sense for you that sort of balance your risk and what you're looking for long-term from a reward. Here's a loan that you could qualify for and go have at it. So that's sort of the tone of the conversations we tend to have. But, you know, again, if somebody comes to us and says, you know, gee, I've just heard that, you know, North Dakota is, Bismarck's doing great and we want to invest there. Now, we don't have infrastructure there, so we're not going to go there. We're in about 10 states and X number of cities that we feel are pretty good for us now. And so we'll bring people in where we have on-the-ground infrastructure, stuff that's in our wheelhouse where we think there are good assets and enough of them and a good economy and it's diversified and the trends look good and, you know, our models telling us things are fine. And so we'll sort of work within those boundaries, if you will.
I recently read that millennials aren't buying homes like our parents did. Why do you think that is? I mean, the housing market, it's kind of bouncing back. The prices seem to be kind of good. You know, why aren't millennials buying homes at this point?
You know, there's a host of reasons, I think. I mean, there's cultural reasons, there's economic reasons, and, you know, I see it in my kids, you know, right? So it's the interesting thing is I think a lot of millennials, when they came out, was right on the back of the big recession, and not a lot of them, you know, a lot of them, their sort of better earnings period got punted out a little bit, right? So, you know, instead of coming out and getting a fantastic, you know, job out of college or school, they had to sort of flounder around for a bit and then got their next opportunity a little bit later. So that's one of the things is that I think they're getting a little bit of a later start than other generations. So the home ownership is going a little bit later. The other thing I think is, you know, people are awaiting to get married and have families, and the new norm is, even both women and men, and especially women as they're entering the workforce. And, you know, I think the big phenomena, again, if you listen to Warren Buffett, that he says why he's so hopeful for the U.S. economy is we are mobilizing a massive workforce of women that are highly qualified, very well educated, better than men in most cases, that haven't been mobilized in the past that are entering the workforce in a very big way. And I think we're going to see that as a massive boost to the economy. Now, the same women now no longer have a need to sort of get married and settle down and do that very quickly. They want their careers to, you know, get to some sort of a steady place. And so they're punting some of those things for a little bit later, and then they have kids before the biological clock sort of starts ticking in a big way. So that home ownership is becoming a little bit later than usual, and I think largely driven by, you know, socioeconomic phenomena that we're seeing right now, right? So I think that's one reason that you're seeing, you know, millennials not jumping into it. The other thing, I think that millennials in general are not huge into ownership. I mean, they're really part of the shared economy. You know, everything from Airbnb to Zipcar to this to that, and they are also very, very mobile. So, you know, I think this is a generation which would go live in London, be in Barcelona, be in Paris, be in New York, and you know, spend some time, you know, different places. Whereas, you know, the older generation said, okay, let me set my roots down in Chicago, and this is where I'm going to do my thing. That's not the case anymore. And so home ownership sort of ties you down a little bit, right? Now you got to pay that mortgage, you got to sell that house before you leave, and I don't think they necessarily want that around their neck. So if you look at some stats that the Urban Institute put out, I mean, in the 90s, 25%, I think, of first-time homeowners, first-time householders rented. In the 2000s, 45% of new households rented. And in the current decade, 62% of new households are renting. We expect 30 million more renters between 2010 and 2030. So there's a massive move towards a rental economy. And it's largely cultural, largely to be flexible, to not be rooted. And some of this is a delay and when you know, millennials want to settle down and have families and do some of that. So all of that sort of adding up to make us much more of a rentership society, which is, you know, good news for investors that want to invest into this asset class. But, you know, that's I think, what we're seeing.
Man, you hit everything, like the nail right on the head. I mean, at least for me, those points really hit home. But one of them that you kind of didn't touch was what I saw with my parents. They bought a home, and I think at its height, it was like $500,000. It was a lot of money that house was worth. And then, you know, the housing market kind of crashed, and their home is now worth, I think, $200,000. But, you know, they had to refinance and do all that stuff. But, I mean, they were paying money for a $500,000 home that's not really $500,000. So I've always been kind of scared to own a home myself, only because, well, is the house even worth that anymore? Yeah. Am I going to be paying a loan that for something that's not worth it, worth that money? So, I mean, is that a fear that I shouldn't have anymore?
You know, it's interesting you have that. I mean, a lot of people have post-mortgage trauma, what I call, you know, which are folks that have been through that whole mortgage crisis and were upside down on their homes, and a lot of them had to walk away, and some had to get their loans restructured, and others took some time before they got where they wanted to be. But, you know, those people actually were more shy of getting into another mortgage and have become long-term renters. And, you know, the thinking sort of goes like this, right? For a lot of people in that generation, even with all this, you know, I'm sure you follow the political environment, with all this reskilling going on, right? There are groups of people who have skills that are no longer congruent with where the demand is, right? As Silicon Valley is paying stuff out of sight, hard degrees, engineering, this and that. And if you have a political science major, or if you're a manufacturing person, or you're in some other industry that's, you know, smokestack and now is going to robotics, I mean, you don't have alignment between your skills and what you can make. So if you look at, from a macro standpoint, really the jobs that are being added are a lot of service jobs at the low end of the wage spectrum, right? So it's not like, you know, you're getting a ton of good paying manufacturing, other kind of jobs that you saw back in the day of white picket fences and, you know, people that grew up after the war and all of that. So what happens there is if somebody's got money in the bank, right, I mean, they may have $1,500 grand in the bank that they can put down, but they're very nervous taking that money and putting it into a home and getting it locked up when they're uncertain about A, their employment, B, you know, whether they're going to see any real wage growth, and C, if they may have to move someplace else to actually find the type of job they need, you know. And that's not really happened in the country, right? A person in Cleveland hasn't moved to Seattle to, you know, reskill himself or herself into a new type of job. And, you know, politicians and others have said this for a while, that, you know, you need to have these technical institutes reskill people, put them in different places so they can, you know, get more geared and aligned with the current economy. But a lot of people just aren't, and some of them are at an age group that they don't want to be. And so, you know, it's tough for them to say, hey, you know, I'm just going to plunk this down in a home, and if something bad happens, oops, I mean, then I don't have any backstop of supporting myself. So there's that trauma, and so the people that are in homes and have it almost paid off and are doing a lot of that are in homes. I mean, they're there, and a lot of them, when they're old and they don't have a lot of savings, they're often selling those homes and doing other things as well. So you've got two generations, right, that, you know, are sort of the Gen Xers who are in that sort of middle space, and the millennials who are in a different space. So it's not, I mean, it's a sort of a confluence of events that's not driving towards home ownership. And there's always that, you know, good segment of the population that are husband, wife, job, suburbs, family, you know, homes, that's going to continue. But that numbers, you know, I think we cranked it up to 69% during the mortgage price crisis, down to like 62.5. There's a lot of economists that are predicting that by 2030 it goes down to 58-59%. So a continued decline in that direction.
So for someone who wants to invest in property, would you suggest that they should flip the home or maybe buy an apartment building or even a mixed lot?
You know, I really think it depends on what their day job is and how much money they have and their risk orientation, right? If they want exposure on real estate, I mean, it's like if I ask you the same question saying, you know, somebody that wants to invest in the stock market, should they do day trading, find some, you know, obscure, you know, emerging market companies. And I, you know, this weekend there was this, I think there's this lady, Ms. Barger, I think was her name, something Barger, an article about her. And it's interesting that she sort of grew up in Saudi Arabia with her dad was CEO of Aramco. And so she speaks French and Arabic and all of these other things and lives in D.C. and goes about her in a little scooter. I mean, she's a real Renaissance person, but her whole shtick is investing in family businesses in emerging economies. And it's absolutely counter to what you would believe, because family businesses are controlled by families. They don't have the governance that you need. But she's found a niche where she finds these families, helps these companies get better governance, maybe helps them get better funding and makes money out of it. She has a very specific skill. So, you know, most people don't have that skill. So you have to go to somebody who is an expert. And people are not normally expert in five different things. So buying a mixed lot, buying an apartment, I mean, you could go upside down in a hurry. You have to engage an expert in the middle. And if it's only a broker, the broker's going to sell you whatever, you know, whatever they have in their backyard. So just like, you know, if you go to a broker who has an apartment, it's like going to a person who's only selling IBM and Apple stock. What do they have to sell you? That's what they're going to sell you. So when people invest, they go to their local realtor. What do they sell you? They sell you something in your own backyard, because that's what that realtor sells. And that's what most people fall prey to. I mean, they haven't diversified themselves. So, you know, you really need to go to an investment management sort of company in the real estate space where you say, this is where I want to spend, and they can put you in many different cities and put you in an apartment if you need to, put you into a home if you need to, put you into a group of homes if you need to. But it's someone else that is an expert whose data you can check and verify, whose credentials you can verify, and you can consume the data, understand all of that, and then make your decision. Now, if you want to go it on your own, then you really need to be an expert like this lady that I just talked about. I mean, most people aren't, but they think they can get there. And it's not easy to get there. There's many pitfalls. So not saying there are not a lot of people that are not doing it. Like I said, there's like the number I hear from some of these lending sites is there are about 15,000 flippers in the country. So if you can become one of them, then make it a full-time job and go find it. And just like if you can become a day trader or somebody who can sniff out deals, then by all means do it. You have that ability. But otherwise, you're better off finding someone that can help you do it, and you define parameters and then do extensive due diligence on the data that's been given to you to make sure that you agree with it. I mean, if somebody, for example, tells you that, gee, I think it's a good time for you to buy, you know, $10,000 worth of Apple stock, and you'd want to know, well, why? You know, I mean, why do I know it hasn't peaked? Why do I know that, you know, the iPhone is not being used? Why do I know the new Samsung's not going to sort of bite into what Apple's doing and Apple's struggling in China, and is that a growth market? And so, you know, if you need a few sort of questions answered, which you don't have the time to do the research, but somebody who does can tell you. And if you buy it, you buy it. If you don't buy it, you say, no, I don't feel good about it. So that's how normal people invest. And somehow in real estate, you know, the gurus and the TV personalities have made it seem like there's a get-rich-quick situation. And, you know, there are no free lunches out there.
I like that. No free lunches.
Yeah, we've heard that, right? Can I say I invented that term?
Absolutely. That's all yours. Yeah. For those that are interested in you and your business, where can they find you at?
Homeunion.com, HOMEunion.com. So we're unique company. I think we're the only ones out there that are doing sort of an end-to-end institutional heavy lifting for retail investors. So we do what the big REITs do, you know, in this space, the single-family REITs that go out and buy properties and fix them up and manage them and do all of the others. We do all of that ourselves, but we do it for retail investors. So we're pretty unique in the sense as we give retail investors sort of a hands-free way to pick from a variety of type of assets that they can build portfolios on and we can manage them for it. And the good thing about the platform also is when they want to sell it, there's another investor that can be ready to buy it. So they can trade it on the platform as well as a performing asset, and they don't have to get the renter out and find a local homeowner and all of those other things.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me on. Enjoy it.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapayne.com. That's MASONVERAPAYNE. MVPAINE.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.